Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 21st of April 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Now, we have a very busy news today because we have an excellent report from Vanessa Beely, of course, is going to bring us up to date with some of the horrific events taking place in Syria. We're also going to be joined by David Scott with Northern Exposure. David obviously reporting north of the border in Scotland. And we're delighted today that he will be joining us with Andy Peacher from Fresh Start Foundation. And quite a bit of today's news is going to be on the subject of child abuse. As we always say, this is the engine of the British government. Mike.
But we're going to just start by mentioning the episode of Inside Vox, which Alex Thompson recorded with the former ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. That is available on the website, on the UK Column website, on YouTube, and links from Facebook as well. Please share this as much as you possibly can. The feedback we've had on it so far has been excellent. Everybody very appreciative of it. I believe Peter Ford himself is quite pleased with how it's turned out. So please share this as much as possible. Now, about 2 hours ago, I had a conversation with Vanessa Beely, who is with Patrick Henningsen in Syria at the moment. So we're going to show that 20-minute discussion now. And we're beginning by discussing the continuing
shenanigans.
Yeah, thank you. Over chemical weapons. Okay, Vanessa, I'd like to start off with the OPCW. We've been discussing this organisation over the last couple of days because obviously they have claimed that the recent so-called chemical weapons attack in Idlib province was as the result of a sarin or sarin-like substance being dropped in the area. As we highlighted yesterday, this phrase, sarin or sarin-like substance, absolutely is one which seems to have originated with the British Foreign Office through Matthew Rycroft and then Boris Johnson. But what we pointed out yesterday was that following this OPCW report, that the Russians were very strongly making the point that, of course, nobody has actually been to the site from the OPCW to make any kind of evaluation. And so they were putting pressure on for there to be an on-the-ground investigation. The OPCW was to vote on that yesterday. We reported that on the news yesterday. Well, we now know that what the result of that vote was. They absolutely blocked Russia's attempt to get an on-site investigation going. Sergei Lavrov, as you would imagine, was not terribly impressed. He said yesterday, our proposal that experts from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons visit the sites of a suspected chemical attack in Syria was blocked by Western delegations without any explanation. And he made the point that London, Paris and the OPCW have given no answers to our questions as to where they took these samples, who took them or when they were delivered. I think we're very close to this organization being discredited. And Vanessa, he absolutely has a point, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, the only person you say that OPCW have not got anyone on the ground. In reality, the only person that has been able to go on the ground is Karim Shaheen, the Egyptian reporter from The Guardian. Now, he entered Syria illegally. He entered into Nusra Front-held territory, which basically is Han Shuhun. We know that the leader of the White Helmets in Han Shuhun, the Han Shuhun White Helmet Center that actually put out this so-called live chemical weapon attack report, is an Arar Sham Nusra Front, so Al-Qaeda, an extremist militant faction supporter. He's somebody that has called for the shelling of civilians in Damascus during the 2014 elections. He's somebody that has advocated sectarian violence and execution of prisoners of war, the looting and robbery of their homes. So, you know, Karim Shaheen was wandering about with fundamentally, again, Al-Qaeda-affiliated extremist factions and Al-Qaeda themselves. And that is where the only narrative, the only on-the-ground narrative has come from. So it's entirely discredited for those reasons. And an illegal entry, again, into Syria to gather whatever information and witness testimony that he gathered. That is the only, let's say, on the ground evidence that we have that I personally would consider to be completely illegitimate. Look, if we have a car crash, how many months does it take to resolve that issue with the insurance companies? You know, this is something that we have to bear in mind. Let's reduce it down to everyday language. And yet here we have, from the beginning of this attack, which, if we remember, came basically on the heels of Tillerson, the U.S. administration basically saying that Assad should stay. We then saw various reactions from the British government that demonstrated their dissatisfaction with this policy from the U.S. Then almost immediately, we saw this chemical attack instigated and put forward by, of course, the predominantly British-controlled White Helmets. And I've just explained who Mustafa al-Haj Yusuf is, the head of the White Helmets in that area. So, you know, as I said, if we have a car crash in any country in this world, it takes months for that situation, minor as it is, to be resolved with full investigation on the side of both insurance companies. Here, we have a situation that potentially already has precipitated a war crime from the United States, violation of international law, the firing of 59 Tomahawk missiles into a sovereign nation with no evidence to base that aggression upon. We've seen ISIS diplomacy from Boris Johnson, the calling for the decapitation of President Assad, which is, you know, pure insanity from a foreign secretary to be making this kind of statement publicly. Again, based on zero evidence. So we're seeing basically the world being precipitated towards major conflict, if not world war, on Syrian soil, on an incident that has been largely discredited by a number of experts and analysts, both inside and outside Syria, independent analysts, and has had no on-the-ground investigation or evidence produced. I mean, this is pure Orwellian, on steroids insanity going on here.
Absolutely. And, well, I mean, a lot of the original reports of deaths and injuries from that also came from the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights, of course, and I mean, yeah, they're not exactly a credible source either. So.
Sorry, just one point I want to make there, Mike, as well, and I don't know if you've made it on previous programs. If you have, I apologize. But one very important point to make is that the Shayrat air base, which was hit by the Tomahawk missiles, that was allegedly the base that contained the sarin gas, or the sarin-like gas that was used against the Nusra Front terrorists and the White Helmet affiliated to Nusra Front in Khan Shahun. Now, if these Tomahawk missiles had hit even remotely close to so-called warehouses of this sarin gas, why was there no proliferation of sarin gas in that area? Why were there no chemical weapon victims in that area when the strikes hit? We also have to look at the strategic importance of that airbase. It's the major defense for Palmyra and for Homs. And we know that at the time when that base was hit, ISIS made a move again towards Palmyra. So we're seeing again correlation between ISIS advances and U.S. aggression. Also, that airbase was used to launch the attack against Israel when Israel violated Syrian airspace. So there's very clear connections between not only the alleged chemical weapon attacks, but various other points for the reason of the targeting of that airbase.
Okay, well, as we reported yesterday, the Russians absolutely believe, or seem to believe, that there is going to be some kind of major U.S. intervention in Syria in the not-too-distant future. So I was interested, because you're in Damascus at the moment, I was interested to get some idea from you whether or what the feeling is among Syrians at the moment about the likelihood of that taking place.
Well, I mean, we're getting sort of at the moment what are unconfirmed reports of various NATO state special forces. Virtually every nation within NATO is here on the ground in Syria, according to unconfirmed reports that we are getting, particularly in the area of Manbij, which is where the U.S. invaded a few weeks ago. Again, completely illegally violating international law on every level. So in the north and the northeast, we have information, as I say, as yet not fully confirmed, but certainly it's coming in from several sources that there are NATO state factions, military factions already on the ground. Equally coming in from Jordan, factions of NATO state special forces. So there is, let's say, a creep mission to a certain extent that is increasing on an almost daily basis. We're also seeing, every day here, we're hearing incoming mortars into Damascus, particularly from the Jobar area, which is where the terrorists made a massive attempt a few weeks ago to infiltrate Damascus itself. And I was actually speaking to a Syrian Arab Army captain the other night, and he said to me that that was a deliberate attempt in correlation with the United States invasion to get inside Damascus. And he said if they had managed to get inside Damascus, a city with 8 million inhabitants, many of them refugees from other areas of Syria, that would have been a real disaster for Syria, because Damascus is such a complex city. It's not even like East Aleppo. It's heavily inhabited. It's very easy, had the terrorists got into the center of Damascus, for them to infiltrate themselves into the civilian and residential areas. And that would have been absolute hell for the Syrian army and the Syrian state and their allies to deal with. So that incursion from Jobar was an incredibly important one to drive back. 200 Syrian Arab Army soldiers were actually lost in that attack. Over 3,000 terrorists, mostly Nusra Front and Jaish al-Islam, were killed. And what we hear every day are the jets overhead. Basically, what they're doing is bombing that area just to prevent the terrorists from being able to fire as many mortars as they have been doing, sometimes 26, 27 a day into civilian areas in Damascus. What they're doing is keeping a lid on it. Because the terrorists are functioning underground, I was told that many of these tunnels spread into areas of Damascus. The tunnels have been there for centuries, and many of them actually go deeper into Damascus. So they can't use heavy-duty bombs to destroy this area, because the shock waves will actually travel through the tunnels into deeper into Damascus and cause damage there. So they're in a very, very delicate, difficult situation dealing with this terrorist embedded in the Jobar area. So what we're seeing is, yes, definitely an escalation in both NATO state activity, illegal activity and intervention on a military basis inside Syria, and an increase in terrorist activity. So we're seeing, again, the familiar correlation between the proxy army and the NATO state military.
Now, the other event that's happened in Syria recently that has hit the headlines was the bus bombing. You were in Aleppo just the day before,
we actually arrived the day it happened. We actually arrived about an hour after it had happened.
Wow. So what can you tell us about that event then?
Just shocking, horrific. What actually happened the night we arrived, it had just happened. So the next day we managed to get to Jibreen, which is an area in East Aleppo that previously had welcomed civilians emerging from the 4.5-year terrorist occupation of East Aleppo. This time it welcomed, or rather it took in for protection, the survivors of this incredible attack. Basically what happened on April the 14th, as part of the four-town deal, which allowed evacuation of terrorist factions, mostly Ar al-Sham from Madaya and Zabadani, in conjunction with the evacuation of civilians from Kafraa and Fua. The civilians from Kafraa and Fua left at midnight on April the 14th. What a journey that should have taken them 45 minutes took them over 7 hours, because the buses were diverted, according to the drivers that I spoke to, into the various terrorist-held villages, where they were taunted, where they were confronted by terrorist threats, where they were menaced by the terrorist groups. And so they were already psychologically traumatized by the time they reached Rashdin, which was the terrorist-held Ar al-Sham Nusra Front holding area, which they had to stop in before they would then be allowed to pass through into Aleppo. That's the only way into Aleppo for them. They were then held in the buses for about 48 hours with limited food and water. The women and children were allowed off to go to the toilet. The men had their weapons taken away from them. As part of the deal, the terrorists can leave with their weapons and the civilians from Kfar Amphora could take their weapons with them as protection. They had their weapons removed from them, so they had absolutely no means of defending themselves. The men were kept on the buses for 48 hours, not even allowed off to go to the toilet. They were given limited food and water, so fundamentally they were starved, and the deprivation and starvation that they'd suffered for 2 years under Arar Sham Nusra Front siege in Kfar Amphora was continued when they got to Rash Din. On the morning of the 15th, members of Nusra Front and Arar Sham turned up with bags, big transparent bags full of crisps, and they let the children off the bus. The children, and I've witnessed this myself in Jibreen in December 2016, swarmed off the buses, not having seen food like this for over 2 years. They allowed them off the buses for 10 minutes. They then put them back on the buses and blockaded them in the buses. Then about 10 minutes before the explosion, I was told by one lady that she'd asked to get off to get some medicine from the Syrian Arab Red Crescent that were waiting to take them into Aleppo. She was told the Syrian Arab Red Crescent had been sent away previously, about an hour previously, which again, they found very strange. Then minutes after that, she said that they opened the doors to the buses, they allowed off the young men and the children. And again, the man appeared with the plastic bags full of chips, and of course the children swarmed towards him, and that was when the explosion went off. So this was a clear luring of the children to their slaughter by this pre-planned, according to everybody there, the entire scene was staged. And interestingly or horrifyingly, two witnesses told me that immediately after the explosion, the women, the mothers of these children, were allowed off the buses for 10 minutes. And during that 10 minutes, she said, Zainab, one of the mothers, told me, she still has 10 relatives missing. She told me that they were filming them with the white helmets moving around. And she said they were filming them as if they were saving them. But they didn't actually allow them to get to their children. They put them back on the buses. They then locked the buses. They prevented the drivers at gunpoint from moving the buses to a safer area into the trees for protection and forced them to sit in those buses and watch their children being taken away, wounded, mutilated, dying, dead, injured children being piled into the backs of four Turkish ambulances that had arrived, again, about 20 minutes or just before the explosion, parked up as if they were waiting for the explosion to happen. And the bodies were driven away with the mothers locked inside the buses, pressed up against the window, distraught, trying to get to their children that were literally being driven away from them. And they didn't know where they were going. We know afterwards that they were taken into Idlib and then they were taken into Turkey. We've had news, although again, I have not confirmed it yet, that 112 out of the 200 that were stolen have been brought back, but none of their injuries were treated. So that begs the question, why were they taken to Turkey? What was the objective of stealing these children on the aftermath of such a heinous attack and taking them to Turkey and then returning them? We wonder whether international pressure through the negotiators, Qatar, Iran, and Turkey has been put on, and of course, probably Russia, to bring the children back. But only 112 have been brought back out of the 200 that I was told were missing from that day. So let's make one thing clear. The iconic picture of the photographer on his knees that has been circulating mainstream media in particular is entirely false. I mean, this man is associated with the White Helmets. He's associated with Nusra Front in Khan Shahun. Of course, he was present also photographing the so-called live chemical weapons attack. And here he is very conveniently again in Rash Din. There's also footage that is taken out of the videos that show him very nonchalantly wandering about photographing dead and dying children before he has his iconic, historic photographic moment in the midst of this carnage. So it's, to me, this is cynical profiteering from the situation to portray the White Helmets and these various terrorist factions as the saviors on the day. Other witnesses told me that the only people after about 5 hours who came and picked up the body parts and actually helped them was the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. Everybody told me categorically that the White Helmets did nothing to help the children or the civilians. They removed the Nusra Front bodies that were caught up in the detonation, in the explosion, and that was it. That was their sole contribution. So, when we see the Western media, of course, copy-paste journalism, The Washington Post ran with the first story, and then we basically saw corporate media in the West just simply copy-paste that article and run with it, with no investigation yet again.
So this, it seems to me, takes the situation to a whole new low. The Telegraph in particular, you thought was pretty unpleasant coverage?
Oh, look, I mean, CNN described this horrific, honestly, Mike, listening to the survivors and watching elderly men in their 70s just weeping in Jibreen Registration Center, watching mothers who had no idea where their children's bodies were, whether they were alive, whether they were injured, whether they were, it's unbelievable. For the Telegraph to then put out a statement saying that these were, they described them as government supporters. Now,
well, we have the quote here. According to local reports, it says a man lured children waiting near the buses over to a car with the promise of food. When several dozen had gathered, a bomb was detonated, killing more than 80 children and 13 women. Most of the dead and wounded were government supporters. I mean, the Telegraph here is almost saying that this was acceptable.
Exactly. So on two levels, Mike, because these were children. There is actually, I've been told by Farah Shahabi, there were 116 children killed. So 116 children, the majority of whom were probably under the age of 10, are described by the Telegraph as government supporters, and that dehumanizes them. It erases them from our consciousness. It's disgusting. And on top of that, even if they were government supporters, why should that be an issue? I have to also say, since I made this point of this abhorrent bias reporting from the Telegraph on RT, this statement has been removed from the article. It's been edited from the article. And we also have to remember the CNN reporter described it as a hiccup. He described the massacre of 116 children, the dismemberment of these children, the prevention of the mothers from reaching their bleeding and dying children as a hiccup. I mean, what sort of world are we living in? It's unbelievable.
Yes, okay. Well, I'm sorry to leave it on that note, but thank you very much for joining us today, Vanessa. What are your plans then for the next period?
Plans are always a little bit difficult here, but the various plans, really. I guess we'll try and head back to Aleppo at some point to catch up with the survivors and also to follow up on a few other investigations there. We'll be meeting with opposition members. We'll be spending time in as many areas of Syria as we possibly can to continue, witnessing the hideous atrocities that are being committed against the Syrian people by our governments and their various terrorist proxies, including the White Helmets.
Okay. Well, Vanessa Bailey, Associate Editor with 21st Century Wire, thank you very much for joining us. We'll speak to you soon. David, I'll bring you in first here. That's the third time I've watched that this morning, and I have to admit, I'm finding it more difficult every time I see it.
I'm not surprised. very moving, very profound, and very... Is not the word. What's the word? We have a situation where children are lured to their deaths, and this isn't viewed as a red line. The governments of the West, who claim to be the supporters of liberty and justice and the American way, don't view that as a red line being crossed. They're supporting, in our name, they're supporting the perpetrators of that. And the media, the mainstream media, dutifully plays along by minimizing the severity. Right? We see lots and lots and lots of photographs of dead children from the gas attack, but not all dead children are equal, it would seem. Yeah. And as for the gas attack, the thing that gets me is if the narrative we've been sold by the British government, amongst others, is correct, that this was a Syrian government attack, there would be no opposition either from Western governments or from the rebels on the ground to a full and thorough investigation. The very fact that there's no access for UN investigators, let alone the fact that it's been blocked by our own government at the UN level, is a strong support for the Assad and Putin interpretation of what happened here.
Indeed.
I think what I'd like to add, Mike, of course, horrific and obscene. The clue to the fact that this has happened and we get the reaction we do from the British government and the British press, the clue to that is in what is actually taking place in this country in relation to British children and the abuse and deaths that are taking place in this country. Because if the government is prepared to allow the abuse and deaths of children to take place under horrible circumstances in this country, we can see that they'd have no problem in allowing these horrors to take place in Syria. And later in the news, we're going to be having a little look at what goes on in Britain. But the other thing I'd like to compliment Vanessa on, really powerful reporting. Why can she report in this way? Well, one is she's got the courage to get in there on the ground and face all the dangers that incurs. But also, of course, she's reporting truthfully. And so along with the truth comes the passion. And there should be passion in these reports because what is taking place is so utterly vile. Contrast the way Vanessa has presented that story with the bland detachment of the BBC, which simply doesn't care if there are a few more bodies, adult or children, as long as they can get the overall news package and boast of their viewing figures.
The other thing that Vanessa told me just before we were recording that today was that they had had reports, she and Patrick had reports while they were out, that some of the weaponry being used by the terrorists includes depleted uranium weapons.
Well, I'm sure it does, Mike, because so much of this stuff is floating around after the Iraq wars. And, of course, that is all Western ammunition.
Right, well, let's move on quickly. British Gitmo, it seems we're going to have our own Guantanamo Bay infrastructure set up, three separate centres being created according to the government, which will form part of a wider government strategy to tackle extremism in prisons, they say. Dangerous extremists will be separated from mainstream prison population and placed into specialist centres. And this is under, well, it seems to be a statutory instrument that's been presented. They're saying that those who are spreading views that might encourage or influence others to commit terrorism, or anyone whose views are being used in a way which undermines good order and security in the prisons, may be placed in one of these centres. The other thing that they said was that it would be prisoners could be placed in the separation centre if they are involved in planning terrorism. This is part of the government statement. If they are involved in planning terrorism, how is it possible for prisoners to be planning terrorism from inside a prison?
Well, we could argue that some of the corporate-run prisons, anything and everything seems to be going on there, Mike. But I think this is going to be a breeding ground and it's extremely dangerous policy. Where does the terrorism stop? Is it all in Syria and the Middle East, or does it become anybody who dares to challenge the British government for what they're doing?
Well, that's a good question and we'll reinforce that in a second. This is what Sam Gyimah, the prisons minister, said. Any form of extremism, he's not talking about Islamic extremism, any form of extremism must be defeated wherever it's found, and it's right that we separate those who pose the greatest risk in order to limit their influence over other prisoners. But the thing that really struck me from the press release was that these centres, they say, form part of a wider strategy to tackle extremism. Again, they're not specifically mentioning Islamic extremism. It's all kinds of extremism, and what is the definition is the question. They say that they are forming a new directorate for security, order and counterterrorism. I find that a very interesting title.
Well, we're now seeing stuff just made up on the hoof at the moment. It's clear that none of the government policy is coming out of Westminster at the moment. There's no proper debate in the chamber about any form of government policies. It was Peter Ford described the deep state government, and that is what we're seeing at work here. It's the deep state that's producing all of this so-called counterterrorism. And what are we seeing? More and more draconian laws coming in, which are bringing us into a prison state.
Mm. Well, new Privy Councillor Tobias Elwood was speaking at Chatham House yesterday, and the more I discover about this man, the less impressed I am. He was mainly talking about the relationship between Britain and Africa post-Brexit, about how we've got to develop trade agreements and all this kind of stuff. So we're going to be basically saying that Africa is ripe for the raping and pillaging in traditional British style. But it was this quote here which really struck me, because he said he was delighted that a BBC film crew had helped to catch a group of chimpanzee traffickers on the Ivory Coast last December. He's visited the area since then and checked up on the chimpanzees. Well, that's laudable, perhaps. But he then went on to mention migration. It's a priority now and most likely still will be when we leave the EU in 2 years' time. Last year, over 180,000 irregular migrants crossed the Mediterranean from Africa. So he's concerned about chimpanzee trafficking, but he's not naming what's going on with migration from North Africa into Europe as being human trafficking. He doesn't seem terribly concerned about that whatsoever.
Well, because he's not, Mike, and somebody in our chat room has picked up on the fact, well, they've mentioned hedgehogs. This is, of course, a reference to Oliver Colville MP, one of the Plymouth Conservative MPs whose priority is now hedgehogs. We've got a man whose priority is chimpanzees. Emotive subject for some people. We say, what's the priority at the moment? Is it the trafficking of children or is it the trafficking of chimpanzees? These are heavily and dangerously reframed politicians. These are not people thinking with any form of normal cognitive process.
In order to keep pressure on Russia, Michael Fallon, visiting Estonia yesterday, he said the UK will stand with NATO partners as he met some British personnel deployed in Estonia. He witnessed the launch of the UK-led Enhanced Forward Presence deployment, 800-strong British-led battle group working with Estonian, French and Danish partners. So that's already good. Let's see what he said. The troops I've met today are part of one of the UK's largest ever deployments in Eastern Europe. This marks our commitment to European security and standing with our allies in the face of an increasingly assertive Russia. Russia may be becoming assertive, but they're not aggressive, which is what Britain appears to be at the moment. Now, in terms of numbers, of course, we're not talking about hugely significant numbers, but this can only be seen as an aggressive move nonetheless, because he just keeps pushing the stick in. The other question that I would ask, Brian asked this earlier to you, these guys must be viewed as cannon fodder.
Well, we're doing the classic. We're putting in the military expertise to train these Eastern European armies, and some of them are militias. So the people who are going to take the casualties and death are going to be those national individuals. We've tweeted out over the last 24 hours, much the same thing is going on. British government stands up and creates the wars, but it'll be the American troops that take the casualties. So we see this time again. We just add this. This was a report in The Telegraph. Jeremy Corbyn described as gutless on defence by Michael Fallon. So what he really means is, well, Labour isn't warlike enough. I thought this was very telling. And this is Michael Fallon. What is this man's expertise in the world? Children's nurseries. A man who was involved with children's nurseries is selected to become defence secretary. How does this work? I think there's some magic formula going on here.
Yeah, there must be. And the other point to make here, Brian, isn't it, is, of course, that says a lot about how people might vote in the upcoming general election.
Yeah, indeed.
OK, quick reminder then, Vaxxed coming to England once again. It's being shown in West London. Venue to be confirmed on the day, next Thursday, 27th of April 2017, between 7 and 10 p.m. Please get along to that if you haven't seen the film already, and support. And if you want to know, keep tabs on the details, get onto the Bring Vax to the UK Facebook group.
OK, excellent. And tomorrow is the British Constitution Group meeting in Nottingham. there are some people who seem to think there's no tickets available. There are tickets going to be available on the door. You've got the opportunity to buy through the website if you haven't already done so. Otherwise, turn up and there will be tickets available on the door. But it looks like an extremely good turnout, and I think this is going to be a very, very interesting meeting against the background of wars in Syria and an up-and-coming election.
What time do doors open?
Doors are going to be open at 10.
Okay.
Right, well, time to bring in David Scott and Andy Peacher. David, take us through, and obviously you can bring Andy Peacher in. This was the first headline, the timeline leading towards the child abuse investigation.
The timeline really illustrates just how little investigation we've actually had. We were told about the investigation in November 2014. It was announced formally December 2014. Susan O'Brien, QC, was appointed to be chair. That didn't happen until May 2015. The excuse was, look at the mess the English have made of picking a chair of their sexual abuse inquiry. We're not going to do that. We're going to be careful. Okay. October was when the inquiry was actually formally set up. So it took, from the first rumours of this coming, it took a year of inaction. That's October 2015. Now, in February 2016, so we're only 5 months into this, a consultant to the inquiry heard Susan O'Brien saying something, or rather repeating what a survivor had said, and took exception to this and lodged a complaint and said that this wasn't the sort of thing that the chair of inquiry should be saying, and it illustrated that she had the wrong attitude, basically. So that was February. Then by May 2016, that event occurred in February. The 9th of May, there was a formal complaint made. The 16th of May, the Scottish Government asked Susan O'Brien to resign. It's a bizarre timeline. There was clearly a decision for other reasons to get rid of the chair. Susan O'Brien refused to resign, but the pressure mounted, and she eventually one of her colleagues resigned, Professor Lamb, and then Susan O'Brien resigned, and then the third member of the three running the inquiry also resigned. So that was the event. So the whole process was one of the government turning on its own inquiry very, very rapidly. And when these people resigned, when Professor Lamb and when Susan O'Brien resigned, they made it quite clear why. It was government interference.
Right, David. David, if I may just interject there, let's just run through some of these headlines to sort of capture it with a little bit of image, and then bring us back on track. So we had the start of the inquiry. So here we've got it: child sex abuse inquiry planned for Scotland.
Just briefly, Brian, as we go through that first one. Right, that was November 2014, and interestingly, what it said is ministers are looking at establishing a high-profile investigation into allegations of abuse carried out in care homes, educational institutions, by religious orders, and by high-profile members of the Scottish establishment. Guess which one does not feature in the inquiry that was actually delivered? Yes, there are no high-profile members of the Scottish establishment being really investigated, because the terms of reference were changed. So there's only children in residential care. No one else is considered.
OK, so then we get to the stage where we're getting people resigning from the doomed Scottish Historical Child Abuse Inquiry. And that leads into the chair herself, Susan O'Brien, quitting. And she produced quite a comprehensive letter to do that.
And can Would you mind if I just quote a couple of pieces of that letter? Because it's very interesting. She said, this is a letter to John Swinney. She said, I'm writing to resign as chair of the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry with immediate effect. I do so with great regret. I am well aware of the shock and disappointment which my resignation will cause to the survivors who have waited so long for an inquiry. I consider that I owe them an explanation, and therefore I expect you to make this letter public. She then says about how she agrees with Professor Lamb and his comments that there was government interference in the free operation of the inquiry. She goes on, she says, hang on, let me give you the end. At the end, she says to him, to John Swinney, moreover, since you have approached the dismissal of a chair so casually on the basis of misunderstandings and inaccurate allegations about my attitudes and beliefs with regard to the survivors of child abuse, I have no confidence that you would not try to dismiss me again at another time, even if you decide against my dismissal now. This compromises my ability to carry out my duty and to ask questions and reach conclusions fearlessly. In short, I cannot reassure the public that this inquiry will be conducted independently of government. My trust that the Scottish Government will actually respect the independence of the inquiry has gone.
Which is absolutely key. And then we get hit with the third resignation. And that finally leads us into this one, which is Lady Smith. So we've got delay, stalling, uncertainty, dismissal of key figures, somebody else appointed. Where does that lead ultimately to the fact that victims feel let down by the child abuse inquiry? Would this be a time to bring in Andy Peacher?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so just as a hand over to Andy, a quote from that last article there. This is from Helen Holland, a survivor of terrible abuse. She said, for a lot of us, setbacks like this reiterate what we were told as children. No one is interested. No one cares. You are of no value to society. So that's what she said. And that was the message that we are reacting to. So over to Andy.
Hello. Hello, Andy Peacher. Thank you very much for joining us. What's your comment on the, what's your reaction to the events over the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry?
Well, obviously, they're not doing it correctly, are they? If there was, they'd have members of the victims, you know, they would be on the inquiry somehow. We know that they do listen, I guess, in the dark secret room to people's views, but you actually need somebody on the panel, I think. That's my opinion. And to that end, this is why we decided, a team of us, to do the Fresh Start Foundation, which is a fresh start, you know, for all child abuse historic survivors. And our aim is to provide a break with the past and promote the eradication of child sexual abuse. And we champion the values of truth and justice. They're the two words that, you know, we've all agreed on from day one, truth and justice. And the people out there are not getting any of that at all. And as David's recent press release, doing it for yourself, doing it for themselves, it's really a poignant sort of clip. And the last bit I'll say for now is a quote from that press release. I will never get justice from any government. I have hurt for 40 years and I will hurt until I die if government has anything to do with it. No one listens to us survivors. I think that's very true.
And Andy, this is a common theme, and I'm going to add a bit to this in a minute, that the government and the authorities don't want to listen, because if they listen, they're forced to investigate. And if you investigate, you find a crime has taken place. Do you think that your initiative and the support that you're getting from survivors and their supporters, do you think you've got enough strength here to really challenge the Scottish government to their on their failure to act? Have you got enough strength to really undermine the Scottish government and show them up? This is a sham investigation, I think, we're seeing in Scotland. Do you think you can really bring this to the public's attention?
Absolutely, because we won't name any names, but we've had some good indications from big organisations already. We have the evidence. We have the abused adults who know more abused adults. Why shouldn't it work? I mean, what can it actually do at the worst? Be the same as what the government's done? I actually think we'll arrange more awareness. And I think, you know, through time, people will look at it our way. And we're basing our idea, well, I had the idea, and one night, believe it or not, it was a dream that a team of us and everyone that's on the team actually came together and said yes. I mean, how spooky is that? But I had this dream that let's follow Shirley Oaks in London and let's start it in Scotland. If it works in Scotland, we'll bring it out England and Wales. But we do need the people. And to start with, we want people to come to the conference or visit freshstartfoundation.co.uk. There's a conference tab where you can get a free ticket. We always believe that, you know, conferences for survivors should, where possible, be free. Please start talking. Start, you know, telling us who abused you. What help do you need? And through common law, we'll make that possible.
Andy, just remind viewers and listeners of the location for that conference and date.
It's the Station Hotel. That's in Perth, Scotland. It's May the 3rd, and that's 1 Leonard Street in Perth. You can Google Fresh Start Foundation on Eventbrite, and the free tickets will pop up.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'm going to say we have a particularly busy news today because of that really excellent report from Vanessa. I'm going to say on air we will give this whole subject more time, but I did want to include this into today's news because it brings this whole thing together about why the British government behaves as it does in relation to children. Let's just go through these very quickly and see where it leads us. Well, the Times here was tweeting out yesterday that apparently Mike lives are at risk because the police still lag behind other organisations in their use of technology. That would be an interesting thing to tell one of the victims who's died as a result of a taser, for example. But I don't think it's the technology. I think it's because the police will not do their job is the reason people are dying. Now, again, Mike, you had this on Cressida Dick pointing out in a recent little speech that actually it seemed she was saying we're going to move on. We're going to move away from child abuse. And I think we're going to show this huge amount of truth that this lady is not interested in child abuse. Now, thank you for the viewer who picked up this. This is Pink News and it's showing Cressida Dick, UK's most senior officer in same-sex relationship. Now, we're not really interested in her personal arrangements, but she said she's very happy. She's a very happy person. She's got a lovely life. She's very privileged. She comes from a warm, close family, and she joined the police because she wanted to help people. Well, all that's very laudable, but we picked up on this part of it where she says violence in all its aspects is what these next 5 years are going to be about. We could have a discussion on that, Mike. From terrorism to hate crime, and definitely domestic violence and our ability to safeguard children. So she's committing herself apparently to safeguarding children. And again, thank you to Roy for sending us this through minutes of an Association of Chief Police Officers meeting in November 2012. Was Cressida Dick present? Absolutely. Why are we interested? Because in here, for the first time ever, we're starting to see information about the scale of missing people and children. And in the second paragraph there, it says that ACPO, Ginty, ACPO lead for missing persons, added that there were 330,000 missing persons cases reported each year. 330,000 missing people reported every year. The figure that I have held for several years is 300,000 per year. This is 330,000. And of that figure, roughly 30%, 33% are children. So the scale of this is absolutely phenomenal. I'm going to leave this just on screen. We haven't got time to run through it, but you can obviously freeze it and read it. This is a transcript of the police whistleblower John Wedger talking about missing children. So think of that figure of 330,000 people, 30,000 children missing. Read his statement. And this is what has happened to this man. And I'm delighted to be able to show him now as a real human being and what a wonderful person he is. From the time he's come forward, he has been threatened, harassed and bullied by senior Met police officers. He's been accused of being mentally ill. He's had his pay stopped. Then he's been put on half pay. He's facing false disciplinary charges. His family are now being threatened and intimidated. And all of this is happening whilst one of his sons is in intensive care. So who is responsible? Well, let's have a look at them. Cressida Dick, head of the Met Police now, has taken no action. No action by British Prime Minister Theresa May. She has been personally informed about what is happening to this man. I called the number 10 press office this morning. I haven't had a reply before we've come live. But on the screen there, we've also got the existing policing minister, Brandon Lewis, no action, and no action from the former policing minister. So let's, couple that picture together. We've got obscene violence used against children overseas in Syria. No reaction from the British government. Well, of course, there wouldn't be, because in this country, the British government not only doesn't care about the abuse, murder and death of children, it is actively involved in the cover-up of that abuse. There is no doubt about it. And of course, David, what you have just told us says the same system is going on north of the border. Just give us closing remarks of 20 seconds. We're in very dangerous times in this country. People covering up child abuse, creating a prison state to put people in prison who dare to question the government.
Yes, questions don't go down well these days. And I'm also looking around the world and I'm seeing increasingly the rise of dictatorships. We've talked about Syria. Now, Syria, a lot of what is destabilizing Syria is coming from Turkey. And in Turkey, we've got a clear move towards dictatorship in the recent changes to the constitution. The reason given for treating Russia as such a threat to the Baltic states is Russia's conduct in the Ukraine. But of course, the Ukraine's another state verging towards dictatorship. And as we see the intrinsic problems in democracy related to once you can vote yourself, other people's money, it's all downhill from there. Coming home to roost in the failure of welfareism and the failure of the Western model where there are meant to be no losers. Something's going to have to replace it. And what seems to be coming in across the world is increasingly authoritarian rule and dictatorship. And that doesn't bode well. And we have to hold on to principles like truth and justice in order to fight that.
David, thank you very much. You've summed it up very nicely. Just a correction. I said for the conference what I should have said is that doors open for the British Constitution Group conference at 9 o'clock. Conference starts at 10, so you can be there at 9 o'clock, but the actual conference itself starts at 10 o'clock.
And in fact, if you're buying tickets on the day, probably better to be there at 9.
Thank you, Mike. We got there in the end.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to say that immediately after this programme, if you're watching the live stream on the UK Column website, we're going to play out the interview that Brian did with John Wedger, the Metropolitan Police Officer. If you haven't seen that or you haven't heard that interview yet, please stay with it and again share that as widely as possible. I just wanted to say one other thing. I noticed in the chat box somebody saying that they had downloaded a copy of the movie Vaxxed from BitTorrent and was happy to distribute it. I would just say, you know, these people deserve our financial support. They are not a big corporate filmmaker. It's a small organization, very small organization. They deserve our support. They're not asking for too much money for it to be streamed, so please support them with your you know, with your hard-earned cash, because they will appreciate it and they do need it.
Okay, that's the end of our news today. We've covered some very, very strong subjects. Can we do something about it? Yes. What's the key? People standing up to be counted and challenging the members of our own government. So that's what we need to do. That's what Nottingham is all about. And this is what we've got to do over the election period. If we don't do it, we can see the type of state that is going to fully establish itself in UK. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back same time on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye.